Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father,
Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles,
and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only King. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Reading from Master's Commentary on the New Testament Bible, it's Discourse 64, The Triumphal Entry into Jerusalem. And being in Bethany, in the house of Simon the leper, as he sat at meat, there came a woman having an alabaster box of ointment of spikenard, very precious, and she broke the box and poured it out on his head. And there was some there in indignation within themselves, and said, Why was this waste of the ointment made? For it might have been sold for more than 300 pence, and have been given to the poor. And they murmured against her. And Jesus said, Let her alone. Why trouble ye her? She hath wrought a good work on me. For you have the poor with you always, and whensoever you shall may do them good, but me you have not always. She hath done what she could. She is come aforehand to anoint my body to the bearing. Verily I say unto you, wheresoever this gospel shall be preached throughout the whole world, this also she hath done shall be spoken of for a memorial of her. And Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went unto the chief priests to betray him unto them. And when they heard it, they were glad, and promised to give him money, and he sought how he might conveniently betray him. Then Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, which had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of them that sat at the table with him. Then took Mary a pound of ointment of spikenard, very costly, and anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the odor of the ointment. Then saith one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, which should betray him, Why was this not the ointment sold for 300 pence and given to the poor? This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief, and had the bag, and bare what was put in there. Then said Jesus, Let her alone, against the day of my bearing hath she kept this. For the poor always ye have with you, but you have not me always. Much people of the Jews, therefore, knew that he was there, and he came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might see Lazarus also, whom he had raised from the dead. But the chief priests consulted that they might put Lazarus also to death, because by that reason of him many of the Jews went away and believed in Jesus. It's interesting having this reading. It's not the one that I was expecting. So it's what happened after this, of course, was that Jesus made a triumphal entry into Jerusalem. But let us read Master and see what he says from these two parallel references in the Bible. Jesus bestowed his recognition of the woman's perpetual honor for one reason only, the sole reason that ruled his every action on earth, that in his instancy of acceptance that God alone can be the highest goal of life, good works for the poor, compassion for the suffering, can only complement but never supplant man's need for acknowledgement of the dependence on his Creator. St. John, in recording that this significant incident took place in the home of the resurrected Lazarus, rather than in the house of Simon the leper, as stated in Matthew and Mark, identifies the woman who anointed Jesus as Mary, sister of Martha and Lazarus, she whose single-hearted devotion Jesus had commended earlier. Mary hath chosen that good part which shall not be taken away from her, because the woman had the spiritual discrimination to offer openly her homage to God, whose reflection she saw in Jesus. In preference to man, even the poor, Jesus gave her his praise as a discerning devotee whom the ages would finally acclaim. Jesus, non-attached as he was to his body, had no desire for attention or honor, or for man's extravagance of adorning and perfuming a mere clod of clay. He was not extolling the personal devotion given to him by Mary, but was commending her sagacity in worshiping the great God of the universe, whose presence he consciously felt in his Christ consciousness. He pointed out impartially Mary's wisdom in offering adoration to the holiest of all the holy manifestations, the Christ consciousness that was templed in him, the living reflection of the one giver of all life, all consciousness, and all virtue, including charitable impulses to help the poor. Thus, when Judas and others of materialistic attitude, hypocritical morality, asserted that Mary would have done better had she sold the ointment and used the income to aid the poor, Jesus reminded them that they had a perpetual opportunity to attend to the poor, but that they would not readily have another chance to show devotion to a visible manifestation of God's presence in bodily form. Such is a rare occurrence on earth. It's a wonderful thing when you begin to understand the scriptures. Master brought the wisdom of the East, of Lari Mahasya, Sri Yukteswar, of his understanding of the scriptures of the East, as viewed through the light of Kriya Yoga and the great masters. And through this, we come to understand the really tremendous incarnation that Jesus represents. In a human sense, he is the manifestation of the divine light. Having attained union with God within his own consciousness, he could now openly manifest that through his body, through his words, his activities. Everything was an extension of that Christ or divine consciousness. It is the expression of divinity within materiality. This is wonderful to know this, to know that man, in general, may come to that highest state of consciousness. This was earth-shattering news at the time, and truly, if it were comprehended by individuals everywhere, it would be earth-shattering news today. So many who follow the way of the Christ as they think of it, think of Jesus as a historical personality, and they worship him from afar. And it is true that many of them feel Jesus deep in their hearts, and they're very sincere in their love and adoration. They have that bhakti spirit, and they really try to live the life, and this is all for the good. But when you uncover the deeper truth, when you come into that mystical knowledge in which that same Christ consciousness exists right within you, right within your own body, right within your own mind. It is the breath behind your own breath. It is the thought behind your own thought. It is so close to you that you can overlook it and not see it for what it is. And this is a great travesty. This is a crucifixion of the Christ consciousness that goes on daily in the vast majority of people. Because we do not comprehend the Christ consciousness that exists within us, nor within our neighbor, much less spread out all over this earth. It's a wonderful saying in the Gospel of Thomas, one of the Gospels that was suppressed. And one of the sayings in that was from Jesus. And he said, the kingdom of heaven is spread out all over this earth. But who has the eyes to see it and the ears to hear it? And the truth is, very few at the time and very few today. The kingdom of heaven is spread out all over this earth. Can you imagine it? Can you see it within your own mind's eye? Can you begin to comprehend the great truth that is being brought home here? Now, we have been so indoctrinated into this worldly sense of consciousness, it's all that we see. And when we look at the world around us, we can become quite a bit despondent about what we see, that man's cruelty to man, that there is warfare in the sea, on earth, and in the air, not just with man, but all nature. One life eating another in order to live. It's a difficult, difficult place to be. There's no doubt about that. And yet, through this boot camp that we seem to be in, the spiritual boot camp, in which we get kicked around quite often, we're expected to rise up. We're told that not to be satisfied with just the appearances of things. I've been working with an individual who's been involved with a family and the death of the family. And it's quite interesting to see, because of the anger that is expressed and the disappointment and the hurt, the tears that are cried. And many times it seems to be a very small thing that triggers all the anger, and all the tears, and everything that goes with it. And the one thing that is not openly acknowledged, the one thing that is truly driving all of the emotion around it, is that they are missing their dear mother. And she is the proverbial elephant in the room that nobody is acknowledging. True, they know that she is gone now, but all of the emotions get played out as if it has nothing to do with their grief for her. Oftentimes we don't see the anger that we experience as grief. Anger is a feeling of helplessness, of frustration, of a desire to set things right. And it comes upon us when we see injustice, when we see things that are being said that we do not believe are true, that we do not believe will lead to lasting happiness, and it makes us sometimes burst out in an anger. And the anger is really a kind of grief. It is a kind of loss. We want this world to live up to its highest light. We want individuals to live up to their highest light. And when it doesn't match our picture of what that's supposed to be like, then we feel frustrated. And out of that frustration comes anger. It all comes down to we have an attachment to how things ought to be. Where we get that picture from, some of it is taught to us and we're indoctrinated into it from a young age. Some of it is attitudes that we take along the way. Ramana Maharshi once said what to many and most, I think, would be an outrageous statement. He said that perhaps Hitler was a yoni. Well, that's a shocking thing to hear. We never hear that kind of perspective. It's an interesting thing in the story of Rama. I've been reading a retelling of the story by a devotee, and it's a wonderful book. And in that story, there is the arch criminal. There's the arch villain that is held out. He's a Rakshasa, and as you can imagine, a Rakshasa is not a nice person. They're a demon. And so he steals a man's wife. He steals Ram's wife, Sita. And when you are told the background of that story, Ravana, who is this evil Rakshasa, was once a great being, and he's guarding the gates of Indra. And Indra asked not to be disturbed. And so he's guarding those gates, and a saint came up and said, "I want entry into this heaven." And Ravana said, "No, I don't have permission to give you that. So I'm going to block your way." He says, "Give me entrance or I will curse you." Just doing his duty, he said, "No, I cannot without permission of my master." And so the saint cursed him with 100 lifetimes that he would have to live in pain and difficulty upon the earth. Well, he was thinking about this curse and knowing that this was a great saint and that his words carried power. And so he was given an option by Vishnu. He says, "You can have these 100 difficult lifetimes, or you can have one very difficult lifetime, and you can help me by coming as that one." So he said, "All right, if it helps you, I'll take the one very difficult lifetime." And so he took this lifetime as Ravana, as his evil Rakshasa, because God was coming to incarnate. And he needed someone to stand up for all of the evil in the world so that when he extracted it from this world, he had a symbol to do it with, that this individual would become that one. And so he served as the oppositional force. It's interesting in Mother's description of her own going through the mystical crucifixion, and her husband was oftentimes playing the role of that oppositional force. He was a great devotee. He was intensely interested in attaining his own realization. And he and Mother were taking a trip that went clear around the United States. And during that time, they were visiting the many SRF centers in order to try to bolster them up. It had been some time after Master's passing, and Rajasi had asked that they go and that they speak and that they help the centers as best they could to keep them going. During this trip, Mother entered into a very high state of consciousness, Nirvikalpa Samadhi. And during that time, those 11 days that she was in that uplifted state, she was seeing visions that took her to the very foundations of how this earth came into being. Her original incarnation in this material world, everything was being shown to her. And as Father was driving and she was having these visions, she would sometimes talk about them and say, "This is what I'm experiencing. This is what I'm seeing." And he, playing his dutiful part as the oppositional force, said, "We paid all this money for this vacation. Look at the beautiful scenery. Why do you have your eyes closed and talking about these visions? Why don't you just enjoy the trip?" If you can imagine. And another time when Mother was having the Kundalini force coming through and she was burning up alive, and they were in a motel room in Bend, Oregon, and she asked Father, "Could you please get me some orange juice and some aspirin? I'm just burning up alive." She is down on the tile floor trying to keep cool. And so he went out and he got some food for both of them, brought it back, and he brought all this big breakfast. She wasn't hungry at all. And she said, "Did you get me the orange juice and aspirin?" And he said, "No, no." He says, "I got you a nice big breakfast instead. That'll do you good." So those ones who are closest to you don't seem, they act like an anchor that helps to keep you anchored into this world, and they also act as an oppositional force. When you're going up, they're determined to stay rooted into the ground. And so when you see people in your life and you're going through these kinds of experiences and they appear to be playing that oppositional force, they're just simply playing an oppositional force. Ravana came in and played his role and played it well. And when Rama first saw him, he saw him standing up on some ramparts and he said, "He is magnificent." And both he and his brother were admiring him. Now, he was a devil. He was a demon, but they were in awe, in a way, of him because he is a magnificent soul. So you cannot always tell by the role that somebody is playing what is the truth about their nature. Again, in the story of the Ramayana, there was one of the wives of Dasharatha, who was the king and Rama's father, and she played a pivotal role in sending Ram out into the jungles. And when bad things were being said about Kaikeyi, his stepmother, Ram said no. He said, "This is providence. This is God who is directing her in this way, and she is not to be held accountable. You should not say anything bad about her." What perfect self-control. He had every right in a human sense to be angry with her, to be disturbed by her, to see her as the cause of his problems. And yet, he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it. Now, in our own lives, it's not so easy, is it? If somebody is giving you a hard time, if they're playing an oppositional role in your life, if they're giving you fits and interference, and you can identify them as the problem. But when you take it and you put it squarely at God's feet, you say, "Lord, this is my situation, and clearly you have orchestrated it for my highest good. My role here is to rise above this situation and to see your presence within it all. And therefore, let me not personalize it to any of your individual expressions, but rather let me see you as the sole cause, as the sole intelligence, and the sole power behind it all. And then most of all, keeping my mind upon you, keeping myself completely open to your direction, let me see what my role is to be. Should I stand up and take a firm point in this drama, or should I surrender and let things unfold as they be? Whatever the test is, whatever my role should be, you teach me, you tell me, you show me the way." And in this way, by reorienting your mind from the outer to the inner, you empower yourself, because when you connect with God, you connect with the sole power of the universe. When you feel you are at the whim of individuals who are on the outside of you, you disempower yourself. Do you see how that works? So you focus upon that wonderful spiritual power and intelligence that's streaming to you even this moment and every moment. And then you play your part. You play it well. If you are to take a strong outer expression, then you do so. And you put your little self aside. There are times when people need to be brought up short, so to speak. They need to be told what's what. And if you don't play your role, and if you are the one who is deemed to do this, then an imbalance happens in the universe. And other times, when you see some inequality or something difficult happening, you let it go. When Jesus looked at this woman Mary, who came up and poured these ointments, she felt the devotion in her. He knew that the time was coming when he would leave this body. And he felt the rightness of it, you see. He went right to the center, right to the heart of the issue. And he knew that it was good. And when he heard these others who were trying to clothe themselves in sheep's clothing, but really they were wolves inside, avarice wolves, talking about piety and money and how the money could have been spent on the poor, he knew that these individuals were not speaking the truth. He knew that they were not dealing with integrity. And so he corrected them. And he showed them how devotion to God is the highest tribute and the highest thing that you can do in this world. Now, Jesus would be the last one to say that you would ignore the poor, for he says any time that you serve the least of these creatures, you serve me, because I am in them, and they are in me. And you cannot separate the two. So he would never say that, but he went right to the heart of what was being said. Right to the heart of what was being done. This is discernment. And this comes about when you are in tune with Christ's consciousness. It takes you beyond your own individual thoughts about something, your opinions about how things ought to be. You surrender all of that. That's not so easy to do. We have our pet ideas. We like the ideas that we have, and we get quite attached to them. And to let go of them, to surrender to them into God and say, now, God, what would you have me do here? Is not always an easy thing. If you see an injustice, you may want to get enraged about that injustice. And from a human standpoint, you would say, yes, this would be the right thing to do, perhaps. But when that rage, that anger, that frustration overrides your knowledge of God within you, then you have lost a great deal, and your actions will not be rooted in a right way. We see that with people who get involved in different movements and different ideas, and they become very dedicated, and they get very wrapped up in it. And they can talk themselves into doing some very wrong things, but they think for the right reasons. And really, they are on a fool's errand. No good will come of it. Jesus ultimately surrendered himself, his life, what he wanted to do. Father, if it be thy will, let this cup pass from me. He didn't want that from a human standpoint. But ultimately, he surrendered himself to it. But after this time of Lazarus and this opening up of these wonderful perfumes, came a time of coming into Jerusalem. Now, this is when the consciousness, and it's an interesting thing when you go through these experiences, because when you go through and follow the Christ steps, you smell these wonderful smells. They have no obvious reason for being there. And they are representative of the different chakras that as they get released, each one has a positive and a negative charge. So some of the smells are wonderful and some of them are terrible. But suddenly you'll have a taste in your mouth or you'll have a smell that's extraordinary. You cannot compare it to anything else, really. It is subtle, it is powerful, it is beautiful. And it comes from the expansion of that sub-power station, that chakra that is within your spine. And then you come up into Jerusalem. Jerusalem is at the cranial center. And it is the wonderful New Jerusalem. It is the Jerusalem that is illumined At least it is in that moment, and as the Christ seed enters into Jerusalem, there is a singing out to God. You feel it in your heart. Everything is being lifted up. Everything is going right. You put the palms down, and there is praising of the infinite divine within you. You feel it with everything in your being. This is the triumphal return. It is not the final experience yet. And this is where some devotees can get off track, because they go through this experience and they think that they have it all, that they have entered permanently into the New Jerusalem. They don't realize. Now, when Mother went through the Nirvikalpa Samadhi experience, she was feeling at that time that she was going through the mystical crucifixion. She had a notion of it at that time. And she felt she was going through steps of it already. In fact, she felt that she had already accomplished a great deal of it before she went to Anandashram in 1957. Now, this was that triumphal entrance of the Christ into Jerusalem. And there's a tremendous quickening and uplifting of the divine spirit. But really, it is just the beginning of everything that is to follow. The crucifixion comes next. The total surrender to God, whatever God would have you do. When Mother sat with Master through the night, after he had left the body, she sat with the body. It was laid out. It was kept for a longer period of time because they were hoping that some monks were able to come from India before they went through the burial ceremony, but that wasn't to be, but allowed Mother to be there and to be with Master all through the night. And as the sun was coming up, Mother then, with everything inside of her, dedicated herself to the service of Master. And so when she did this, she bowed down to his stocking feet that he was laid out on the bed there still. And she grabbed hold of those feet and she pronounced and she put her forehead to his feet. And even though this body was supposedly now not inhabited, was dead, a tremendous electric shock went out from Master's feet into her forehead and out throughout her entire body. And she felt the Master had accepted her prayer, had accepted her in discipleship in this new way, because she had given herself, even though she had been so dedicated and so much a part of his ministry for so many years, she felt that she gave him herself to him in a way that she never had before. And so as a result of that, she entered into this new stage of consciousness, this coming into New Jerusalem, of establishing New Jerusalem within the consciousness. That means the divine consciousness is now the resident within your own consciousness. Your inner city of the brain is now illumined with light. It shines with light. When you close your eyes and there's no other light source outside of you, you see this beautiful light illumining your entire cranial area. You're uplifted, you're attuned. There is no longer, once you have gone through this total transformation, you are no longer lured outside of this divine consciousness. It is everything to you. And you are completely dedicated and surrendered to it. There is no part of you that acts in opposition now. We're coming into this Thanksgiving week. This Thanksgiving week is a wonderful time of year because it is a holiday that is totally dedicated to giving thanksgiving to God. You know, the early revolutionary days, when there was a battle that went well or another battle that didn't go well, the entire nation would do a day of fasting and prayer. And I believe it was Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. He said a wonderful thing. He says, we pray O Lord, that you are not on our side, but that we are on your side. Isn't that a wonderful prayer? We pray that you are not on our side, but that we are on your side. It puts everything right. It puts everything right when you think to be on God's side. And so we have this tradition of prayer. It's more recent that it's become an established holiday that happened with Franklin Roosevelt. But it's a wonderful time, but there's a rich tradition that goes with it. And for us to set aside everything, you don't have to do it just at the Thanksgiving meal or when there are so many others around. In the quiet of the morning, Thanksgiving morning or the quiet of the evening, and you set aside everything. And you think about Mother and surrendering herself to Master, to be in service of Master as she did. And you think about all the things that you're grateful for, all the things that God has given you. And you open your heart, you open your soul, you open everything inside of you in thanksgiving and in praise, in love, and deep and total and complete surrender. That's a way that you can make it a very personal and a very profound kind of experience and a true thanksgiving. I'd like to read to you a story from Papa. I'm going to read it because he tells it beautifully. And it's a true meaning of wealth and charity. Manal Devi, the famous Rajmati of Gujarat, was a very generous-hearted queen. Once she went for darshan of Lord Somnath, taking with her 1¼ crores of rupees worth of gold. She weighed herself in gold and distributed the wealth to the poor, jubilant over the merit acquired by the Queen Mother by this great act of charity. Her son, Raj Siddharaj, remitted the taxes payable by his subjects to the value of several lakhs of rupees. Now, Manal Devi became so proud that she believed nobody in the world could be as charitable as herself. Bhagwan Sama, who wanted to save his devotee by teaching her a lesson, appeared before her in a dream and told her, "A poor woman has come to my shrine for darshan. Go to her tomorrow and beg of her to give you the merit she has amassed." Roused from her sleep, Manal Devi fell to thinking over the dream. Finally, she came to the conclusion, "This is nothing too much for me. I'll give her some money and purchase her merit." Accordingly, in the morning, the Queen Mother sent messengers to find out the woman devotee. Soon they brought her to the old pilgrim, a poor Brahmin woman. The Queen Mother told her, "Give me your merit in exchange for whatever wealth you wish to have." The poor woman refused to offer without any hesitation. The Queen Mother was surprised and asked her to describe the nature of the merit she had acquired. The Brahmin woman there narrated her story. She said, "After leaving home, I wandered for many months in hundreds of places as a mendicant. I have at last reached the sacred place, Somnath. Yesterday was a day of fasting for me. Today, a holy man gave me a little food without salt. Half of this I offered to Lord Somnath. Of the remaining, one half I gave to a guest, and with the rest I broke my fast. What merit have I gained? I'm an insignificant creature. You are a great soul who has acquired a lot of merit for yourself. Your father, brother, husband, and son are all rajas and princes. You have, according to reports, performed Shankarji's puja, spending more than a crore of rupees, and your son has granted remission of taxes amounting to many lakhs to commemorate the great event. Having acquired so much merit, why do you ask of me the little merit gained by me, a poor woman. If you won't get angry, I will tell you something more." On Manal Devi's assuring her that she was free to speak out her mind, the Brahmin woman began to explain why she is not willing to exchange for money the merit of her humble devotion. She said, "All material wealth in the world cannot yield the peace and joy that pure love for the lotus feet of the Lord gives to a true devotee. However poor, low, and humble the latter may be in the eyes of the world, there is no wealth equal to devotion. So that is why I refuse to part with even the smallest measure of the merit of my bhakti in exchange for your vast riches. It is not enough to have money. More precious than wealth is the right to conduct and true unbargaining love for God. So one should observe the rules of Dharma. Surely it is not enough to have power. One should also have patience combined with humility. One should control one's mind by practicing vows and spiritual disciplines from youth. Even when one is in extreme poverty, one should never refuse to give alms. These rules, though seemingly insignificant, are highly important and must be followed by all devotees." Hearing these words from the lips of the Brahmin woman, Manal Devi's pride was destroyed. She expressed her gratitude to the poor woman. Shankaraji, the Lord of Samath, out of his infinite grace, had sent the Brahmin woman to teach this precious lesson to the Queen Mother. So in our hearts, in our souls, this Thanksgiving week, let us give great gratitude for the bhakti, for the love and devotion that God has given us for God. Let us not overlook that. Let us not see it as insignificant or something small. It is the greatest, it is the most precious commodity you will ever have. And it comes as a free gift. And when you value it as you would value some piece of gold or some treasure that you would hold, and you treasure it more than that, then it will grow, and it will grow. I was thinking about how we all write in the book of our life, and we're constantly writing every thought, every action, every word goes down into the book of our life. And I was thinking about our wanting to know God. And what if we were just as anxious to know what the next page on God's page was as we were if we were reading a novel that was a thriller and we were going from page to page and the author was adept at making a cliffhanger at the end of each chapter and we just couldn't wait to get to the next one? What if we were that focused, that anxious to know what is on the next page that God has been writing out for us? That when we go into meditation, it is with a thrill. What will God show us today? What treasures will come to me? Spiritual treasures of upliftment, of inspiration, of new knowledge. Earlier this week, I had the most wonderful spiritual experience with Krishna. And part of that experience, I was telling Krishna that most of all that I wanted for all of us, was to feel the infinite spirit of Krishna in the heart, in the soul, always, without form, always a knowingness that that presence was absolutely there. And that all devotees everywhere should feel that, not focused on the outer form, but rather intent upon the hidden treasure that is already residing within each and every one. Let us not take lightly the many gifts that we have been given, but in especial Think of the spiritual gifts. Just the fact that you are interested in the spiritual path means God's grace has touched you and is sustaining you in that interest. And that she should carry you all the way to your spiritual home is the greatest treasure we will ever have in this world. And it is truly something to have great thanksgiving for, even just to have our feet to be put onto the path. If you'll join me in prayer. O Heavenly Father,
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of Thy glorious presence,
of Thy glorious presence
in every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for
Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
And surrender myself to Thee.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss
of my communion with Thee.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
May the infinite divine be awakening Himself within you, expanding your soul so that you merge into oneness with that Spirit, with that love, with that feeling of gratitude. And merge your little soul into the vast infiniteness of God.